It's 26 minutes to 12. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC as we continue to pick over the carcass of the American presidential election. Let me invite one of my favourite carrion crows onto the programme now. Simon Marks has been covering events with customary aplomb. It's the morning after the night before for you, Simon.
It is the morning after the night before, or you could argue, James, that it is a new dawn here in Washington, D.C., and it is quite literally a new dawn. I am still in our broadcast position directly overlooking the White House, and on a drizzly morning, the sun is slowly coming up over the city. The lights have gone on at the White House over the course of the last hour or so since I got up and dared peek out of the window and realized that no, it wasn't a dream. It did all actually happen. And look, I mean, the picking over of this, the recriminations after all of this, particularly for the Democrats, I think is going to be long and is going to be very intense. Let me just give you some of the reactions that I've been hearing. First of all, I've received an email in the last hour or so by a former top senior Bush administration official in the government of George W. Bush, who was not backing Donald Trump, who has sent me an email that simply reads, "A second day that will live in infamy." The first day, of course, that lives in infamy being the attack on Pearl Harbor back during the Second World War. Deeply, deeply depressed about what has happened. And within the Democratic Party, the recriminations have begun. Someone I know who has worked with both Clintons and still occasionally works with both Clintons has sent me a series of text messages. "It is our party's fault. We let her bully us into clearing the field for her. She was a deeply flawed candidate, totally out of touch with the electorate. I am furious not at Trump, but at my party for allowing this to happen," he writes. And what did he allow to happen? What did she rather allow to happen? A situation in which Donald Trump will succeed Barack Obama in the Oval Office next January, pledged to overturn virtually everything that Barack Obama views as the principal planks of his political legacy. It must be a nightmare behind those white walls that I'm gazing down at the moment. And the other thing that's been unleashed here is a Donald Trump who just 24 hours after he was calling Hillary Clinton a crook, a criminal, corrupt, she shouldn't be allowed anywhere near the Oval Office, found himself addressing that gathering at the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, paying tribute to her public service. And after all the violent and bigoted rhetoric that he had used on the campaign trail for month after month after month, actually suggesting to the American people that they now should rally around and unite around him. Take a listen.
"At the same time, we will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us. We will be. We'll have great relationships. We expect to have great, great relationships. No dream is too big. No challenge is too great. Nothing we want for our future is beyond our reach. America will no longer settle for anything less than the best. We must reclaim our country's destiny and dream big and bold and daring. We have to do that. We're going to dream of things for our country and beautiful things and successful things once again."
Donald Trump speaking last night after it became apparent that he had won this race. Hillary Clinton had telephoned him to concede. We haven't heard from her yet. We think we'll be hearing from her during the course of the next few hours. An absolute body blow for her and her top campaign aides. And, you know, to give Donald Trump his due, whatever you think of his politics, whatever you think of the way in which he carried himself on the campaign trail, this is a man who saw what no conventional political analyst in Washington, D.C. saw from the moment he entered this presidential race 16, 17 months ago until last night. He saw the visceral fury in the Rust Belt states, in some of those key battleground states, with what he argues is the exporting overseas of American jobs and opportunity, and he understood that there was a political opening there for him that most conventional political analysts denied existed. It is, in in stark political terms, James, an absolutely astonishing achievement.
It certainly is. Do you think he has any red meat to throw those people, though, once he's in power? Well, I mean, how do you reverse the 20th century?
Look, I mean, I think he's got a whole series of difficulties. First of all, he's got to think about appointing a cabinet, and there are so many prominent Republicans with experience in government who want nothing to do with him that it's going to be very interesting to see. There was talk last night of Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, as the next Secretary of State, of Rudy Giuliani, the former Mayor of New York, becoming the country's next Attorney General. I mean, his bench has not been wide or deep. He's got, you know, a handful of people at this point to choose between. So the Republicans will have to start figuring out how they're going to fill all of those key government positions. How is he going to bridge the divide that exists between him and Republicans on Capitol Hill? On paper, he's in a magnificent position. He's going to become a Republican president with majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate. He's going to be able, pretty much, as long as he can find comity with those Republicans on Capitol Hill, to do whatever he wants. But your question goes to the heart of the matter. Does he have a detailed plan? We never really heard it. I mean, the plan, the slogan, was
great.
Make America great again.
It's a great plan.
It's the best plan.
It's a beautiful plan. I suppose we have to stop laughing now, Simon Marks.
No, because
it's
seriously, I mean, what does it mean to say you're going to make America great again? We're going to see how he chooses to define that in the course of the next weeks, months, and years, and whether he's actually got any red meat to throw at them, or whether in 4 years' time, once again, the electorate is in the mood for a change candidate, and by then Donald Trump will be the candidate of continuity. Well, we'll see what happens when the election of 2020 dawns.
Good Lord. I just briefly, Simon, before you go, when you mention this ability or this tapping into the rage that he did, do you think he had that at the beginning? Because I wonder sometimes whether or not he's been as surprised as everybody else has by the scale, both the quantity and the quality of that inarticulate fury that he's tapped into. And oddly enough, I know that some of his closest advisors were telling him to listen to a lot of talk radio, where you get a lot of very, very angry people who don't seem to change their views when they've been shown that their views are wrong. And that's pretty much him in a nutshell.
I think this was a two-phase election for Donald Trump. I think when he got in, it wasn't really a serious bid to become president of the United States. He thought it was going to be a good bit of branding. And I think he genuinely saw something else that the rest of us didn't see, that this country was ready for its political process, its electoral process, to be turned into the political equivalent of a reality TV show. And that he accomplished with the willing complicity of the major media outlets in this country. The television networks in this country gave Donald Trump an absolutely free ride because he was good for ratings. He's box office. Yeah. Les Moonves, the chairman of CBS, said during the primary campaign, he, Donald Trump, may be dreadful for America, but he's great for CBS. That allowed him then to eclipse the competitors that he faced in the primary field. When he won the campaign for the Republican Party's nomination, I think suddenly at that point, he brought to his team people like Stephen Bannon from the very far right Breitbart News, people who themselves understood the rage that existed in some of those communities. And that's, I think, when phase two really began and he started to sense that there was a political opening for him. But, you know, also we should mention here the role of Melania Trump. From the very first day that Donald Trump announced he was going to be a presidential candidate, she, behind the scenes, was telling him, if you get into this race, you will win. And I don't think that was simply a coach trying to you know, get the candidate ready for the Olympic sprinting final. I think she genuinely believed it, and he started to believe it at a certain point during the campaign as well.
And, well, they were both proved right. Simon Marks, many thanks, not just for your contribution to today's programme, but for your sterling work on LBC throughout this remarkable presidential campaign. 11:43, top quality journalism from Simon and everyone else who's been in America for LBC. You're currently listening to James O'Brien on LBC.